Today in lecture three, I want to continue on our journey of learning about various supervised learning algorithms. And in particular, we're going to start talking more about neural networks in detail. But before doing that, I kind of want to give a little bit of motivation of why we're studying a few different types of algorithms, rather than just diving right into neural networks. So let me show you some results quickly from this survey. This survey was put out by Kaggle. Has anyone heard of Kaggle before? You've heard of it? Yeah. So they're a group, they put out different contests, they put together various data sets and tutorials used for machine learning. So every year for the past several years, they've put out a survey of machine learning and data science. Lots of different interesting things there. I'm just going to present a small piece of the results. So the survey in 2021, which I'm presenting the results for, had over 25,000 responses from data scientists and machine learning engineers. So they are presenting on their background, there's questions about their salary, all kinds of things, and just day-to-day what kinds of machine learning algorithms and what kind of platforms they're using in order to do their work. And in particular, the question I kind of want to just talk about briefly, there was one question where the respondents were asked for their most commonly used algorithms in their work. And so they could choose more than one option. It was just saying, out of all of these options, and there, you know, there was also an other option, but out of these options, you could check a box, you can check as many as you want. Which of these do you commonly use in your work? And again, this is from data scientists and machine learning professionals. So you might not have heard of all of these. We haven't talked about all of them yet. It's totally okay if you haven't heard of them, but I think based on discussions last lecture, a lot of you were familiar with you know, the fact that there's various different kinds of neural networks. So I just thought before I show you the results, does anyone want to take a guess for some of them? For example, linear regression. We talked about last time, what percentage of respondents would you guess said that they're commonly using this in their work?
30%?
Okay. Any other guesses?
I'd say probably higher.
Higher? I just want at least two guesses, guys. Just say anything. So we can have a competition of who's closer.
Is there going to be something like the most likely one is just regression?
We'll see. I'll show you in a second. But I'm more wanting you to guess like what percentage of people say that they commonly use this. Because again, they don't have to pick just one, right? They can pick multiple. So let's just think about like one. So we're going to talk about neural networks, specifically dense neural networks. We're also going to talk about convolutional neural networks. Convolutional neural networks are a really common kind of neural network. So what percentage do you think there people are using them commonly?
45%.
62. Okay. Anyone else want to give any guesses? You know, just, you know, for fun. Anyone want to go on the record for any of the other items here?
Ooh. I think it's going to be like a 12% use evolutionary approaches, but they're really cool.
Uh-huh. It's a good 12%. Yeah. It's a good 12%. Yeah, of course. It doesn't mean, just because it's not as common doesn't mean it's not important, right? Yeah. Okay, cool. Anyone else want to give any guesses for anything here? Okay. So it turns out I've actually ordered this list in order from most common to least common on the survey. So... Yeah, you guessed it. So logistic regression and linear regression, 80% of data scientists and machine learning engineers say that they're commonly using this in their work. So of course, a lot of other kinds of neural networks, they're really important as well. And so convolutional neural networks, around 40%. Evolutionary approaches, it was 6.
Convolutional is around what?
Yeah, sorry, it's a bit small. For about 40%.
Yeah.
I'm really curious about the 2.4% of people who said that they use
none. Yeah, why are they filling out the survey, right? Yeah, that is a little curious. They did say they cleaned this data before they presented it, but I don't know, maybe they somehow didn't clean the people that didn't give an answer. Yeah, that's a bit funny. Yeah, so the reason I just wanted to show this is because last time there were a few questions of like, is it really worth learning linear regression before learning neural networks. And I think this, you know, is at least some indication that in some fields that are active, this is still really actively used. And so I think it is worth studying some different approaches to studying these problems. And yeah, I was kind of surprised by these results too. So I thought that was fun to see. Okay, so now I'm going to go back to the blackboard. We can lift up the screen. So we are still going to spend a large portion of this class talking about neural networks. We're not going to make the decision of our curriculum based on this survey of how we're going to weight different pieces, but so let's kind of just remind ourselves of basic definitions in supervised learning, more just to remind you of the notation that I'm using when I talk about supervised learning, because it's going to be different everywhere you look. So the idea there is that we have some data set. It consists of data points with dimension dx and some labels with some dimension dy. And what we want to do is fit some function to represent this data set. And the kind of way that the parameters that define this function are kind of how we define the algorithm that we're using. Well, yeah.
I don't know if someone might have asked this question, but in the survey, I mean, if people who have no idea what the other options are, if they look at the names of the things that the survey that is shown to people, they would probably choose linear regression because, well, I mean, linear regression exists in statistics. So they would say, I've used this.
Yeah, before. So I was wishing that there was more information there of exactly what kind of jobs the respondents were employed in. So there was a question about what their educational background was, and there the most common was master's level. That was responding, but there weren't any questions, at least that were presented in what I saw. I don't know if they just didn't present the results for all questions they asked, but there was no question about like what field do you work in. So I don't know if that's mostly people working in finance or sciences or what exactly it is. But it is people that are declaring themselves to be data science or machine learning, data scientists or machine learning engineers. So it's not just anybody.
Also, something else that is, some of the methods are newer. So, for example, GANs, I think, came out like 2016, 17.
Mm-hmm.
And so it hasn't been that much time for people to get up to speed. And also, GAN, it would be a subsection of convolutional neural networks. So anyone who answered GAN also says CNN. But anyone who says CNN doesn't necessarily say GAN.
I guess GANs are usually like a form of generative modeling, and maybe with convolutional neural networks, they're meaning those used for supervised learning. Like there's some distinctions there, right? I guess like GANs are made with some convolutional layers in them.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess we'll see in this course what is meant by convolutional neural networks. I would guess they're actually meaning ones that are used for supervised learning where you do have labels. I think that's probably what differentiates it. But of course, yeah, people are maybe going to talk about still having layers that are similar to a CNN within other types of architectures, for sure. Yeah.
Wait, could you do generative modeling that is supervised, or does it have to be unsupervised?
Usually I think of it as being a type of unsupervised learning, but yeah, I guess people kind of, we'll talk about this later in the course for sure, but I guess, pardon?
Call it semi-supervised.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can like massage these things to be accomplishing different types of tasks. But I guess formally we usually consider them to be a type of unsupervised learning. Any other questions? Sorry, I should have stopped for more. It is an interesting result. So any other thoughts on those results, comments? Okay. So, today, what I want to do is kind of dive into feed-forward neural networks. We will get into convolutional neural networks, but that'll be a later lecture. So first, we're going to talk about just how these neural networks are structured and the different degrees of freedom that you have in them. So we'll talk about weights, biases, activation functions. Then we'll spend a bit of time talking about how expressive these neural networks are, so how flexible they are at representing different data. And then, if we have time, we'll get into a little bit about how you train them with terms such as cost functions and learning algorithms. So we call these feed-forward neural networks. Kind of sketch it for you. Okay, so we have something like this. The way I'm gonna label it, the way we define our layers is based on these vertical sections. Okay, and the way that information flows here is just from left to right. So I input the components of a data point, x1 all the way to xdx, and in the end, I get some output from my last layer. So the circles on this graph, these are all called neurons, and the notation that I'm going to use we're going to use like an N with a subscript L to talk about how many neurons are in a given layer. The number of layers is going to be, in this case, we would call it three layers. I'm going to call that capital L. Output from a given neuron, I'm going to store this in a variable A. Like this. So, with these definitions, what this means is that the number of neurons in my zeroth layer is the dimension of my data set. The number that I should have in the last layer should be the dimension of my labels. And what I'm feeding into the first layer from the left is just my input, so I should have this. Haven't like fully explained how the information propagates, but does this setup so far make sense, kind of? Or any questions so far, I should say? Maybe it can't fully make sense yet, but. Okay, just interrupt anytime if you have questions. So let's just zoom in on one neuron of this network. So zoom in on one of the neurons that has input and output coming to it. So it's going to take input from the previous layer And what it's going to output is this AJL that I've defined. And it feeds this output actually into every neuron in the next layer. So just to emphasize, these are actually all the same output. So, you know, I really could there's really only one unique output on the right, but I just draw it as going into everything on the next layer. Okay, and how is that defined? So I have to sum over the output from all the previous layers. And I multiply by a weight. And then I also add a parameter called a bias here. And moving forward, I'm going to.
Sorry, Lauren?
Yeah.
Is the output of the neuron all the same?
So everything that you're feeding into the next layer is, it's going to, so let me just move this down. So this neuron, for example, it takes all of the inputs from the previous layer, it calculates an output, it feeds that output into every single neuron in the next layer.
But doesn't it, like, don't the lines have weight?
Yeah, so then... Yeah, of course. So then this line is then AJ, and then AJ gets multiplied by a weight.
Then I'm the weight. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Before it's calculated. Okay.
Yeah, this is before the weight is multiplied there, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's that's this here. So for every line connecting, there's a weight. Yeah, so here I'm just writing like what's coming out of it, and then, yeah, we also have to weight by this, by some factor for sure, yeah. Any other questions about that? Okay. So this is specifically how we calculate that. Then this G here, we call this an activation function. And then the W's are called weights. And there's one weight for each, I guess, link on this graph, each line. Each link between neurons has some kind of a weight associated to it. And there's a bias associated to each neuron. OK, and what it actually means for a network to learn is that it's going to be adjusting these weights and biases. Okay, and then in practice, we might write this output as a vector. like this. And then if I do that, what I get out of the last layer is just going to be the function f of x that I'm trying to fit. Okay, so let's just talk for a minute about these activation functions and what we can choose there. So I'm going to give you a non-extensive list of some of the functions that are commonly used as activation functions. The one that's maybe most historical is just a perceptron. So a perceptron is basically just a simple on or off function. So what it's going to do is it's just going to be off if the input to this neuron is less than 0, and it's going to be on with a value of 1 if the input is greater than 1. So this can make certain types of analysis or proofs simple in some situations, and maybe kind of resembles what we might think of as neurons in the brain that are just either firing or not firing in some theories where they're described. So there's a lot of ways that maybe this is nice conceptually to think that, you know, either we have just something on or off, but can anyone just think of any problems maybe that might arise if we choose something like this?
It's not differentiable.
Right, yeah, exactly. So often what we're going to see coming up is that when we're trying to learn things, we're going to need to be taking derivatives of functions, and here we'll just have a derivative of 0 and then something discontinuous. So this is going, we'll kind of see, and this will make more sense as we proceed through, but learning is going to be difficult with this function. Okay, so let me show you some other choices. One of them, I can't remember who said it, but somebody mentioned the sigmoid as, I think you mentioned it, right? As one of the things when you think of machine learning, you think of sigmoid. And I just realized I have the wrong choice here. Okay. So this is another common choice. That looks something like this. This is another choice that we can use. It's kind of a flattened, it's kind of a broadened out version of a step function in a way. In the next tutorial, part of it will involve trying several different activation functions to see how it affects the performance, but this is something that's going to depend on the properties of the data set that you have, so something that you in principle have to just play around with. Okay. We can also have a hyperbolic tangent function. It again looks pretty similar. I'm not the best at drawing it. It looks like it's going up there. Just note now you'll see the bounds on this function are no longer from 0 to 1. That's okay. Sometimes the output from our network we want to interpret as a probability, or we kind of know what values the output should have. So then we're going to want to do some adjustments or some scaling to make sure that we have the correct range. But in our intermediate layers, there's no reason that we have to be just between 0 and 1. There's also a rectified linear unit, a ReLU, it's usually called. So this one is just 0 on one side, and then it has a constant slope on the other side. It's pretty surprising that this one works, but it turns out that in many situations it can work pretty well. And then there's another choice, which is kind of a smoothed out version of this ReLU, which I'll also just show you because, again, this one kind of has, on the left-hand side especially, it's just going to be have a derivative 0 all the time, so something that'll kind of fix that. So this will just have this value. Now we have to introduce another parameter called alpha in order to define how we want to do this. And then, as I said, this is not an extensive list. There's other functions that you can choose, but these are just some that we're going to be looking at in the tutorial and in the homework for the data sets that we're looking at in order to kind of see which ones we should put on different layers. We also don't have to put the same ones on every layer of the network, so we'll also play around with choosing different ones and study how the performance depends on this. Any questions? Okay, so in our networks, we're often actually maybe. Yeah, of course.
What's the benefit of having both the weight and the bias? Since we relate the bias to it, why do we want to have two parameters to adjust?
Why do you want to have two parameters? That's a good question. I don't know if anybody else in the room has thoughts on. I've never really looked into training something without a bias. I don't know if anybody has tried it in doing something with just weights. Let me just put this up. So, yeah, I guess this is just kind of the simplest linear input that we can be giving with the full flexibility where you would have like freedom to add a constant. Actually, I do have an answer to that, which is going to be in the next section that we talk about, which is how expressive a network is, so how flexible it is to represent different functions. So there's a really nice proof, which I won't go through all of, but I'm going to tell you the link to it if you want to go through it. And it actually kind of walks you through, and there's really nice little plots that you can play around with where you adjust the weight and the bias, and they show you that with both of those parameters that you can adjust, it just gives you that flexibility to represent more functions. So let me actually, I'm going to say a little bit more about this after I write down a few more things, but yeah, that's a really good question. Thanks. I'm going to come back to it. Other questions? Okay, so with these activation functions, just to remind you, when we're at kind of an intermediate stage of our network, the output from a neuron doesn't necessarily correspond to something physical. Of course, there's some papers where people try to analyze what it might mean to have an output on a certain layer, but the layer where we really have to think about how it corresponds to our data set is what comes out of the last layer. Let me just note. For classification problems, what we really want to be determining with our algorithm is which class out of a discrete number of choices our input is most likely to correspond to. Okay, so what's common is that on the very last layer, you'll use an activation function called softmax. And in this case, it's a way of normalizing the outputs that you get. And this means that you can interpret your output in the end as a probability. For our data set, we might have discrete labels, but as output, we'll actually get continuous values that will kind of tell us the probability of being in each case. So this is a common way to get that on the last layer. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The softmax function, why do we need the exponential in order for it to be interpretable as a probability? Like, if we were to just have, like, Zi over the sum of Zi, that still is like proportional to the values of the thing. So it seems kind of Like, if we had some different normalization thing, that kind of intuitively feels like a probability. Why do we need the exponential?
Yeah, you don't need it, I don't think. So it's, I guess one benefit is that it's always going to be positive, right? So you'll always get something positive out of it. It's not the only choice, though. Again, like, this is a non-extensive list of activation functions. You could try something else.
But, like, why specifically is this a probability distribution over the inputs, said sub I?
Oh, in the sense that you're going to get the number of outputs that you get from your layer. You have 1, 2, up to dy. The sum of all the outputs will now be 1 that comes out of here.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And they'll all have values 0 to 1.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's now talk a little bit more about this idea that you already alluded to of how expressive a network is and why we're kind of choosing this structure the way we do. So I'm really just going to tell you some main points here. But if you're interested, I would really encourage you to look at this reference. It's a fully online textbook. I link it in the portal. And they give a really nice kind of visual proof of how expressive these networks are. It's really interesting. And you get to play around with different little widgets and stuff. It's fun. OK, so. So it turns out that neural networks satisfy something called a universal approximation function. So if I'm given some continuous function, it turns out there exists a neural network. And in fact, one of the ones that exists is one with only a single hidden layer. And this network can approximate your function to whatever accuracy that you need. And I know this is not a complete answer to your question, but let me just say that when you go through this, you will see that the biases really are important in being able to arrive at this result. And so it comes from the fact that we do have weights and biases both as degrees of freedom in this function. So this approximation theorem sounds really great. And in fact, it's part of the reason, I think, why people are so excited about neural networks, because in principle they can help us learn anything, right? But let's just talk about some caveats of this theorem. So does anyone have any thoughts on maybe, you know, not why we shouldn't get too carried away with being too excited about this result? Is it really just magic? Is it just saying, okay, we've done it. No matter what we have, we can approximate it however we want. Yeah.
I think there's more than just approximating functions in the world. So.
How so?
Well, it's like when you're doing science, you're not just saying like, oh yeah, we have some data and we want to have a function that fits the data. Mm-hmm. It's like you have some assumptions that you're making about the model, and you have some structure to the theory, like with words that you're explaining what you're doing. So I think that the universal approximation is not like, it's not going to solve every problem in the world.
Right. So yeah, you're absolutely right. So just to make sure I understand what you're saying, like what's an example of something you might want to do, which this would, you know, not really give you what you want?
Like, I don't know, like any physical theory, like the standard model, like you can't just say, oh yeah, we have an equation, that's the theory. Like, it's like you have to say like, well, what assumptions are we making about it? Or like with quantum mechanics, you can't just say, oh, let's find a function that'll fit the data set. You have to have some structure for like the mathematics that's going into it.
Sure. Okay. So if I understand what you're saying, but correct me if I'm wrong, you're saying that just because we can approximate a set of data to arbitrary accuracy doesn't mean we can actually interpret physically what's going on, right? Okay, so that's a great point, yeah. I don't know if that's a way to summarize what you're saying, that it's useful to be able to have a function that can represent our data. If we have a finite data set, we can then see how it could give us additional data points, but it doesn't necessarily tell us something physical. Yeah, cool.
It doesn't say anything about what the width of that hidden layer would have to be.
Yes, exactly. It might have to be really huge, for sure. Yeah.
Especially because we're fitting a continuous function.
Yeah.
So that should have an infinite number of input nodes, right?
Yeah, so as you, or, no, the input, so look up here, the exit values can be continuous, right, here? Even if I just had a single x, it can be continuous. So no, you don't have to have an infinite number of input nodes for it to be considered continuous.
So
it just meant the nature of these x's. Are those x's just plus and minus ones, or can they take continuous values? I mean, it could include perhaps a case where you're trying to take the limit where. No,
I
don't.
What was the vector that you fed into this? It was.
To the network?
Yeah.
It's x. So the network, what you feed in is x, which is like x1, x2, x dx, like this. So what we're saying here is that all of these components are continuous here.
So our function, like this is like a like dx values that we want to evaluate for our function f? Or?
That's the input to our function. And I think we're also, you know, we're also actually assuming that the function that is the output is continuous, which is not necessarily the case either in what we're trying to do. If we're trying to do classification, that's not the case, right? But I guess the idea is that you could maybe approximate some of these things with arbitrary precision to some continuous function. But I'll come back to you, but let me just write down what you said, because it was a great point. The neural network we need might be really big. The number of hidden layers. And in fact, you know, we're not saying that we can actually find something that's equivalent to this function. We're saying we can approach it with arbitrary accuracy. As we say that we want more and more and more accuracy, we're going to need more and more neurons in this hidden layer in order to do this. But sorry, is there?
So like, I'm just trying to get, because like, let's say we're doing like computer vision, or like we're classifying like written text or something. That we'll have some grid of pixels. And it's my understanding that you feed this grid of pixels as input to your neural network. and then at the output it'll give you a classification, like whether it be like 0 to 9 or something.
Yeah.
So, like, our function that we're trying to approximate would take, like, a data structure the size of, like, the grid that we're inputting, right?
Yeah, on the left, yeah.
Right, but this function is a continuous variable. It's like, the number of nodes in our computer vision neural network will be the size of our...
Yeah, so in that problem that you're proposing, the input would be some picture that we have to say it's on a grid.
Yes.
So yeah, the number of nodes that we input would be all of these.
Right.
And the values, yeah, it depends on how you're storing that. If you have maybe RGB values
right.
for colors, or if it's just black and white, it's maybe one value that you normalize to be between 0 and 1.
Right. But for a continuous input, I don't understand how you could feed... I guess I'm confused. Like the x, like each of those RGB values could, let's say, be continuous from 0 to 255 or something. But the actual, like, what we're feeding in must always be discrete or something. Is that true?
You mean that this is a problem because it's a grid?
Yes. Like
no, that's not. That's not. It's just these. X values that need to be continuous. So again, here, like you would be assuming that your, like you said, your pixels can take any continuous value from 0 to 255.
Okay.
I mean, we can even consider the very simplest case of just one output. Like I want to just take an X as
right.
input, a single X. I would just have one neuron on the left.
Yes.
This is my X. This can, whatever the values are, depending on your data set. It might just be an X that goes from 0 to 255, 0 to 1, something like that. But we can consider more general setups where we put more than one input.
Yes, yes. I was thinking of X as, like, if we fed it, like, an infinite plane or something. You know, like, how would we...
Right,
yeah.
So, I don't... I'm not sure that this proof applies
yes.
to that
right.
limit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe there's one... There's... So I'm just stating one universal approximation theorem. There's actually... others, because you know this one corresponds to a network with a single layer. People also study different versions of this theorem where you study other kinds of structures and in what limit can you have universality. But yeah, this is just one version of it. Okay. Anything else that you would see as kind of a caveat to this theorem that we should be careful about? Let me just tell you one more. So this theorem tells you that such a function exists, but it doesn't mean we're going to know how to find it, right? Actually finding it can be extremely difficult, and we don't actually know that we will be able to do that with the methods we have. Okay, and one last thing that I'll say that we have to be careful about is that when you have something that's more expressible, sometimes it can be more easy to have a case where you're overfitting your data. So we have to be more careful about overfitting in these kinds of situations. So if our data has noise, how do we actually make sure that we're fitting what we want rather than the noise? That can be difficult with a more expressible function. Let me just read you a quote I wrote down from a paper, which is one that I link on the references here, an archive paper. It's a really great overview of machine learning for physicists. And when they're talking about this theorem, they say the applicability of the approximation theorem in practical situations should not be overemphasized. So again, it's very exciting, but we basically, in most cases where we're introducing neural networks, we're going to show this, and then usually people will say, okay, it's great, but let's not get too excited. Let's still be careful, right? We don't want to just take some huge network with tons of parameters that's really flexible. there can be problems we have to be careful with in doing that. Okay, so in the last few minutes, let me just say a few words about what the learning and training process looks like in these networks. So this is a discussion that we'll continue next time, but let's just start off with a discussion of some of the pieces we need to put into our algorithm in order to make sure that this neural network can learn what we want it to. So one ingredient to do so is a cost function. So just to remind you, the goal of supervised learning is to, or sorry, if we're using neural networks, is to find the weights and biases that best approximate our data set. So what we want to do with our neural network is to find the weights and biases we need so that when we have an input X, the output that we get from our network is close to the label for that data. And let me quantify what I mean by close. Okay, and we use a cost function to measure how well we're doing at accomplishing this goal, basically. Okay, and just like with activation functions, there's not just one cost function. You get to choose how you define it. So the first one is just a mean squared error. Similar to what we saw with gradient descent. Also just write this as
like this. So I look at the output from my network, compare it with my label vector, and I look at the difference. Another one, I'll only talk about two, is something called the cross entropy. And this one specifically works when all of the elements of your output are between 0 and 1. The end now, but let me just say next time we're going to look at algorithms that work to minimize this cost function. Talk about different options for doing that. We'll revisit gradient descent, actually, although in this case, it's a little more subtle how we actually use gradient descent and how we update all of the parameters in order to do this minimization. And then we'll also talk about some other more sophisticated versions of gradient descent that we can use in order to do this. Does anyone want to ask any questions?
Cross entropy different from relative entropy? Like KL divergence?
Oh yeah, so KL divergence is something that we, yeah, although I think there's a relationship between them, specifically for a certain simplified kind of algorithm, I think you can look at equivalence. Yeah, so I'll come back to you on like more of the details on that, yeah. Usually
Because like I know that the formula for like KL divergence relative entropy is different from that one, but like they look kind of similar to me, so I'm sure there's some relation.
Yeah, no, I think there is. So I'm most used to seeing KL divergence in unsupervised learning, which is again a case where you don't have labels, right? So here we have labels. The Y are labels here.
I see.
Yeah, so that's one difference. But yeah, I just don't want to say, like, I was just reading something recently, and I just don't want to say something that's actually not true. So I'll come back to this next lecture, if that's okay. I'll read it, and I'll give you a more clear answer. Other questions? Okay, so this is our last lecture of the week, so I'll see you next week.